Grand, well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak here, and to be described as senior and notorious in the same morning is something I shall take forward here and use to my advantage. I'm going to talk a little bit about advances in cardiology, and this is, and I'm a cardiologist based at Torbay Hospital, where we have a slightly smaller scale setup than there is in Derriford at the moment. And I'm trying to make this relevant to acute and general physicians, and therefore there's not too much very interventional in it. I'm going to talk a little bit about some new drugs and a little bit about some new procedures. And moving straight into the medications, just in terms of the antiplatelet drugs, which I thought I'd cover first, the indications for these drugs haven't changed over the last year or so. We use them for medical management of acute coronary syndrome, and they're a vital part of management of patients after coronary angioplasty and stent implantation. But we don't just use clopidogrel now, and we've got prasugrel and ticagrelor, which you will come across when people are being admitted with non-cardiac problems. They all do the same thing, broadly speaking. They all bind to this ADP receptor on platelets and inhibit platelet aggregation. But they are different in terms of their actions. Whether or not they're reversible is different, although it doesn't make a practical difference to their usefulness. They are described as, or advised to be used for slightly different groups of patients, and I'll mention some of that in a moment. They do have some different interactions, which is potentially important. This cytochrome is part of the cytochrome P450 family, and it is activated by this cytochrome, or clopidogrel is activated by it. The others aren't. Now, that matters for a couple of reasons. There's a reasonable minority of us who don't have this form of this cytochrome and therefore don't activate clopidogrel and therefore don't respond to it effectively. And one of the issues with these antiplatelet drugs is the small proportion of patients who don't get a beneficial platelet inhibitory effect from them. Detecting those patients is something that is not straightforward and isn't part of routine practice. The other issue behind this is that there was a story a couple of years ago, really now, about problems using proton pump inhibitors with clopidogrel, and that you might get an increased risk of stent thrombosis by interfering with this cytochrome. I think, in practical terms, that hasn't proven to be a major issue, but it was all based about this interaction. A more relevant or more pertinent, I think, however, is that with this cytochrome, and I've got no idea what that's part of a family of, but with ticagrelor, it causes a problem, and the problem is that certain common drugs like clarithromycin can give an important reduction in the antiplatelet effect of ticagrelor and therefore cause problems. And so there does need to be some awareness if they're on this drug to keep their LAD open, then giving them that drug is a really bad deal when they come in with an infection of whatever type. The other important differences between them is the time it takes to inhibit the platelets and the extent of platelet inhibition that you get. And clopidogrel is relatively slow and relatively modest, and the other two have a more rapid onset of action and a more profound effect, which is why they have advantages under certain circumstances. It does give an indication, however, of the extent of platelet inhibition you need to keep your stents and coronary arteries open. We're not aiming for 100% with these people. So NICE, as with everything else, have told us what we need to do on this basis, and it is quite a useful way of summarizing the data that are out there. And prasugrel is a drug that is recommended as an option for patients with an acute coronary syndrome who are going on to have immediate angioplasty. Essentially, that means primary angioplasty for ST elevation MI, although it's not exclusively STEMIs that it needs to be for. The other groups of people for whom it's useful are people who've had a stent thrombosis despite clopidogrel. So if we detect one of our non-responders by the fact they come back a week later with a blocked stent, switching them to prasugrel is a useful therapeutic option. There's also some evidence from a sub-study that diabetics did particularly well with prasugrel over clopidogrel, although personally I've never been very impressed by that, and that's partly because the bleeding risks with prasugrel increase in certain groups, and it's not recommended to be used if people have had a previous stroke, if they're very light, or if they're very old. Although apparently they're diabetic with a previous stroke, weigh 40 kilos and are 83, it's all right. And somehow I don't quite believe that. But they have some limitations of which people they can be used for. Ticagrelor is probably the newest one on the block in terms of this. And this is for patients being medically treated for acute coronary syndrome or being treated with angioplasty, all in combination with aspirin. The issues with all of these drugs, obviously, is bleeding. They're antiplatelets, they will increase bleeding. They've all got similar half-lives, so if somebody comes in bleeding, stopping the drugs has some benefit. Surgeons still like patients to be off it for 5 days before they open their chests, which always strikes me as slightly long, but there we go. Obviously, if somebody does come in bleeding on these drugs, and they've got these drugs on board because they have a stent in place, there's an important risk of stent thrombosis occurring with stopping the drug, and it needs to be a balanced discussion in terms of the risk of bleeding versus the risk of infarcting. And stent thrombosis with infarction carries a significant mortality with it. If they keep bleeding, you can give them some more platelets and that might help. And the other important side effect that might bring people to attention is breathlessness. And with ticagrelor, this is supposed to be as high as 14% of patients get some dyspnea, or in the study, got dyspnea felt to be related to the ticagrelor. Now, that was in comparison to about 8% of people on clopidogrel, which was highly statistically significant. But the rates of discontinuation of the medications for that side effect were actually much lower. Nonetheless, it's something to bear in mind if they represent. And the difficulty is, of course, that lots of these patients have got lots of other reasons to be breathlessness, like residual ischemia and left ventricular systolic dysfunction and other things, but it is there in the mix. Moving away from them and going on to anticoagulants, I think several people might mention these types of drugs, and cardiology is one of the areas where they're being used, but these are newer things coming forward. Dabigatran and rivaroxaban, and there's additional products coming on down the line, but these are the two endorsed by NICE at this stage, as options for thromboembolic prophylaxis in atrial fibrillation, in non-valvular atrial fibrillation. But atrial fibrillation has got important risks of stroke because of broadly similar groups of risk factors for stroke, like previous strokes, bad hearts, heart failure, being old, and other comorbidities. And they are there as useful options to warfarin. Dabigatran comes in two doses, and if you take it at the lower dose, it's about as effective as in preventing stroke as warfarin, but you get fewer bleeds. So that's quite good for somebody who's perceived to have a slightly higher than typical risk of bleeding on anticoagulation. If you give them a higher dose of dabigatran, you get better protection against stroke, but they bleed more. So that might be better for someone who's got a lower risk of bleeding, but a particularly high risk of stroke because of an accumulation of risk factors. Rivaroxaban, which is a different class of drug, is pretty similar to warfarin, non-inferior in one and similar in the other, so it gives you an equivalent level of cover. Rivaroxaban also now has this license to treat pulmonary embolism, which dabigatran doesn't, so there's a difference in some of the other patients that will come through with it. And why might one use them? And I don't think they've been taken up with great alacrity anywhere in the peninsula, as far as I can tell. But you don't need to monitor them, and patients don't need GP visits and dose adjustments. It's a standard dose. Just take it and see how you get on. There are fewer dietary and fewer drug interactions, which can be helpful. But on the downside, there's no antidote, there's no reversing agent. Importantly, they're not licensed for prosthetic heart valves, and in fact, dabigatran is absolutely the opposite of licensed. The MRHA have said it's contraindicated for thromboembolic prophylaxis or in stopping valvular thrombosis with prosthetic heart valves. So these are not drugs that are replacing warfarin entirely. I don't know if it's absolutely because of no data or if they've had significant adverse events. I would guess because it's come from the MRHA, they probably had some yellow slips coming through saying my patient's aortic valve clotted off. It's not been studied in that population. And if they're bleeding, well, you can stop it and they will wear off over some hours. Dabigatran apparently can be dialyzed. You can give them clotting factors, which can help to reverse the process. And there is reportedly a monoclonal antibody that inhibits dabigatran that's being developed. So there may be more things that come through when these people come through the door hosing blood although largely speaking, it's stop the drug and support with standard measures. So moving away from blood, I was going to talk a bit about ivabradine, which many people may have heard of already as a drug that's sort of third, fourth line treatment drug for stable angina. It's an IF channel blocker, and that's the funny channel. Literally, that is actually what the F stands for. A funny channel blocker that acts selectively on atrial tissue and particularly on the sinoatrial node. And by doing so, it slows your heart rate down, and that's very good for angina because you've got less cardiac work required, more time to perfuse the coronary arteries, and thus less ischemia. So it improves angina. So it's like a beta blocker, but it's not a beta blocker because it doesn't upset asthmatics or have any of the other beta blocker side effects. And I wouldn't normally put the trade name in, but it's otherwise known as Procoralan, if anyone's wondering why they've never heard of this drug. The change is that it's now also licensed as part of the treatment for heart failure, or for heart failure due to left ventricular systolic dysfunction, not the other causes of heart failure. And that's based on this study, which is a couple of years ago out of the Lancet, decent-sized study of patients with a pretty good, pretty well-established, significant levels of heart failure. So they had poor ejection fractions, symptomatic heart failure. They'd been admitted to hospital within the previous year because of heart failure. Importantly, and really importantly, with any patient on ivabradine in sinus rhythm, this drug has no role for patients in atrial fibrillation because it only treats your sinus node. But the trial included patients whether or not they were already on a beta blocker and was a randomized controlled trial between ivabradine and placebo. And if you just look at the hazard ratios for the outcome, particularly good if you took the patients who had a resting heart rate greater than 75, and you got significant benefits in terms of reduction of death rates, heart failure death rate, heart failure hospitalization, but also reduction in any cause hospitalization. So it's not the case that you make their heart failure better, but they all come in with syncope and fractured hips because you've made them bradycardic or fall over. There's an overall benefit from the drug being included. And as such, it's now supported by NICE again as an option for patients meeting these criteria, which is in sinus rhythm with bad heart failure, but it's irrespective of whether or not they're already taking a beta blocker. So they're on their maximum tolerated dose of beta blocker and the heart rate's still 76, they can have ivabradine. It's not a drug error when they come in with that combination. It's a drug error, the heart rate's now 40, but if it's still all right, they can manage it. So, procedures. Got to talk a little bit about procedures, and some people may have heard a little bit about renal denervation. Who's heard of it? Hands up, anybody come across it as something that's out there? Fine. It's being looked at for the treatment of resistant hypertension. And resistant hypertension in the UK has got quite a strict diagnosis. Resistant hypertension, for the studies looking at this, wasn't quite as strict. And they were just saying on two or more antihypertensives, typically you have to be on three or more, probably including spironolactone, and have serial measurements of your blood pressure. But in the studies, this hasn't been looked at quite so hard. Now, why might it be necessary? Etiology remains enigmatic. It certainly remains enigmatic to me, and as far as I can tell, it remains quite enigmatic to lots of other people as well. It isn't fully understood. There are a number of effects of the autonomic nervous system that have causative and consequential effects on blood pressure. If you have hypertension, your sympathetic nervous system is activated, and other factors that increase blood pressure, like obesity and inactivity and mental stress and despair and all those other kind of things, will activate that sympathetic system. And sympathetic activation will give you arterial stiffening, and that will aggravate hypertension. And you will also get signals coming from the renal afferents because of hypertension, because of renal injury. And huge amounts of work has been done on this, and nobody quite understands it, as far as I can tell. But there is a critical role of the renal autonomic system in systemic hypertension. And what's the most important evidence? Most important evidence is if you interrupt that, their blood pressure goes down. And there was a big role for surgical sympathectomy, or not a big role, but it was investigated for the treatment of systemic hypertension, and it's quite an effective means of lowering your blood pressure. Unfortunately, it causes such intolerable side effects, it's a useless treatment. And that's surgical work from 30-odd years ago. But then percutaneous renal denervation has been developed. Now, this is a completely different kettle of fish in terms of the procedure. It's a catheter-based procedure. You go up from the groin, or you could probably reach it from the wrist if you really wanted to. So bring a catheter up from the groin, stick it in the renal artery, put a short wire in. These beautiful yellow things are the autonomic nervous fibers, and with radio frequency ablation, you cook them and you destroy them. And it's pretty selective in terms of the sympathetic system. It's pretty straightforward. This is a big artery near the bottom without any desperately important organs at the end of it, and is therefore attractive. The evidence for this is stunning. This is not a typing error. That's the name of the Medtronic system that has been investigated for this. And the first study is a case series of 153 people with resistant hypertension who had renal denervation, radio frequency ablation, and got really pretty impressive reductions in blood pressure with very, very few side effects or complications. And a blood pressure reduction that appears to be maintained, although actually in the case series, the number of people included in the series when they reported it who got out to 2 years, this is about 20 people. So it's not that they got 153 for whom they have 2 year data. The second stage was the second Simplicity hypertension study with a massive population of 106 people. But this was a randomized control trial, and that was randomizing them to denervation or continuing medical therapy with the same tablets that weren't controlling their blood pressure. But again, a pretty impressive blood pressure reduction over a short time scale in a small number of people. And Simplicity 3 is recruiting, so masses of evidence. But there's an awful lot of excitement about this out there for reasons that I think aren't very medical but are fairly clear to see. This is potentially an enormous market. If you can do a single procedure to a patient, reduce their blood pressure permanently by 30 over 15 for years without any important side effects or complications, the market is endless. It's easy. There's nothing very complicated about sticking a catheter in a renal artery. Spoken as someone who's never done it, but it can't be that difficult, frankly. And it does appear to be safe, and it does appear to be effective. There are at least 20 companies currently developing radio frequency ablation systems for renal denervation, which gives an illustration of how excited they are all about it. And if you can pick the right one, some people might make quite a lot of money, but knowing which one's going to actually win the market share, I think is very difficult. Where are we in the UK about it? Well, NICE said it should only be used with special arrangements and emphasized that research needs to be ongoing. The Joint Societies spoke earlier, or about a year ago, and they gave very detailed recommendations of how patients should be selected and which MDT they should go to and how the procedure should be done and where they should be monitored, which is actually very helpful. And then this group, the NHS Commissioning Board, who've taken over sight of about five or six different areas within cardiology, have grabbed this one as well. And they said at the end of last year that it'll be commissioned through a very small number of centres, 12 centres in the UK, maybe doing 30 procedures each a year. So a lid is being kept on it, completely appropriately, because the evidence is not out there, but it may be that this develops very much. And if there are patients in specialist resistant hypertension clinics who are not getting control, this may become an option relatively rapidly. And the last thing I was going to talk about was about coronary intervention and about some potentially changing indications for this type of treatment. And some of this comes off the fact that primary angioplasty is much more readily available, so there are now emergency interventional programs available. I believe even in Derriford now, is that right? They've managed to create their own. So we have to think which other patients might benefit from emergency angioplasty. Out-of-hospital arrest is not uncommon, has a dreadful prognosis with it, but there are some registry data that now suggests that if those patients are taken to the lab, have emergency angiography and or angioplasty, they have a twofold increase in survival. You know, a twofold increase in survival from rubbish to less rubbish, but still an important difference. And another important fact that comes out of those kind of registry data is that ST elevation itself is quite a poor guide to the etiology of out-of-hospital arrest. So when someone comes in and they've been shocked by the ambulance and you take their first ECG, the fact that it doesn't show ST elevation does not mean that they haven't got a critical coronary lesion or acute coronary syndrome as the cause of their arrest. And in keeping with that, ventricular fibrillation is a relatively unusual heart rhythm And by far the commonest cause of it is myocardial infarction. So if you have VF in the community, that's by far the likeliest cause. And the other aspect of it is that, while there's some evidence, therefore, that intervention for these people can be useful, we can also now use emergency intervention as part of the treatment for these people by artificially keeping them going while they get into the cath lab. And this is a device that we use at Torbay. Other companies have different things. This is called an autopulse device. A backboard, patient's head goes up there. This band goes across the chest, like that. There's the control panel near the head. You turn it on, and that band circumferentially compresses the chest rhythmically and noisily. And it can be very successful. So to complete, I was just going to give you a case vignette of a man in whom we use this device. This is a 59-year-old man who came in to our emergency department with chest pain, and he had an anterolateral STEMI. And after he got into the emergency department, he went into VF. And that was recognized immediately. It was witnessed, and he was treated very promptly with defibrillation, but he remained in VF. And this was despite CPR and adrenaline and amiodarone. So we fitted one of these devices onto him, had him tubed, took him up to the cath lab. And this is one of the first images we got. That's the coronary catheter coming down. That's his left main stem, and his circumflex is coming down this way. His left anterior descending artery should be going over here. And the fact that it's shaking up and down like that is the effect of the autopulse. And these big bits of metal in the way are all part of the autopulse setup. And I won't run you through the whole series, but if I just go on a little bit. In this view, there's a wire down, which you can, in fact, there's two wires down. I think one down the diagonal, one down the LAD. If you can make out little black bits at the end of a more solid bar up there, that's a stent going into position, and a stent was deployed, restoring flow. And most importantly, restoring flow and then enabling successful defibrillation. And in this last image, the movement is because of cardiac contraction, not because of artificial chest compression. And the important things about this, he had this on for more than an hour to maintain his circulation. It gave an incredible blood pressure during it. I mean, he had adrenaline and things on board as well, but a systolic of 175 with external compression is pretty good. And he went home on day 11 without any neurological problem. It is not the case that every patient with whom we've used this has been an outstanding success, but it can be useful. So, to finish, we've got new drugs for acute coronary syndromes and angioplasty, new drugs for AF, new drugs for heart failure. There's new treatment for heart failure, and being alive is no longer a necessary criteria to get an angioplasty. Thank you very much.